Welcome back to Second Hour Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stenzel, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about the news media, and we're pleased to have back with us Rick Kaplan. He's been here a number of times before, but it's been a while. He has a lot of experience in broadcast news. He worked at ABC and CBS, worked at ABC on some of their flagship shows like World News Tonight and Nightline. After that, he spent a little time at CNN and then just recently has been hired to run MSNBC. He's a graduate of University of Illinois, so periodically comes back here and spends some time working with journalism students. And when he's also here on the campus, he has included us as a stop on the itinerary, and it's always interesting to talk with him.
Yeah, you're right in there with, Papa Del's Pizza. Wouldn't come here without doing
such
both of this.
Distinguished company.
Indeed.
Pizza and Focus 580. People who are listening have questions. You can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So you got a new job.
I do. So I'm president of MSNBC. Now I've made all the networks now. And it was actually funny. It was what Bob Wright said to me. He said, you know, I'm going to give you an opportunity you haven't had in your 30 years. And I go, really? He says, yeah, you can work with the really good anchormen. So that was how he got me to NBC. But I'm really happy to be there. It's fun.
Yeah. You have this reputation of you're the guy that they call when they're in trouble.
Kind of, I guess. And sometimes get in trouble, getting to places that are in trouble. But this is the most wonderful of opportunities because we're in last place, but we have a staff as talented as any staff in the business, and we have a chance to do some good things here, and we're going to take the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. You know? Well, when they hired you at CNN, this was a time when CNN was facing increasing competition, and what they wanted, you were the guy that they brought in to grow the audience, which didn't happen, but I don't know that anybody can necessarily hold it against you or anybody who was in that job just because of the reality of. And it's even more pronounced now, an increasing number of news outlets that seem to be chasing a shrinking audience for news. So the question is, well, just what kind of audience can you expect?
Well, is it a shrinking audience or is it an audience that shrunk because you didn't meet their expectations and needs? When I went to CNN, and it's no different at MSNBC or at any of the networks, what I think you have to do is improve the quality of the presentation. You have to improve the depth of the news and the depth of reporting. You know, there are people who are NPR addicts, and I use as my example that the reason people tune to NPR, and it's the only news source that it's gone up dramatically in audience. It's up 400% in listeners, whereas broadcast television and cable television is down 30%. 30% in audience in 15 or 20 years. And the reason that you'd have to say NPR's gone up is not because they have funny jokes or great music or any of that, but they give you value. You have value-added information here. People listen to these shows. You listen to interesting people. People come away from the radio program, and they feel that it was time well spent. And I think what's happened with television is because of the internet and because of 24/7 cable, people come to the set or the radio. They come, and they know a lot more. My Cronkite audience, you didn't know until Walter said, good evening, here's the news, what the deal was. If I asked you to take a look at a transcript of a show, circle what you didn't know, you wouldn't have a whole lot of circles. In 70, you'd have a ton of circles on that page. In 30 minutes, you might have 30 circles. If I gave you a transcript of tonight's program, and it's the same for all the news presentations, and said, circle what you didn't know, well, between the internet and news radio and 24/7 news networks, you know the headlines. You know a lot more. So if all we do is give you back those headlines or a veneer of reporting, it's not as satisfying for you. It's a much tougher job to do the news today than when I first did it in 1970.
Yeah. Well, there is. Things have changed a lot since then. But one of the things that has changed is that during the time that Walter Cronkite was doing news at CBS, the news was not expected to make money. Well, now the news division is expected to make money.
See, but I think that's a dirty little secret. I think that they always knew that news would make money. But remember, news started making money because they started doing more news. News started making – when it was just the evening news, you know, you're talking in those days. At today's dollars, it costs you $300 or $400 million to do a news division. And if all you have is the evening news, and in the old days it was the morning news and the evening news, that's it. Well, there's not a lot of places to make back your money. But now that each network has two or three magazines for an hour. The Today Show's on 3 hours a day, not 2 hours a day. There's Nightline 5 nights a week on ABC. There are other news programs that are on. Sunday shows have taken on added value. They're an hour now. And what you find is there are many more places to bring in revenue, and that's why you started having this upsurge in business. And because a show like 60 Minutes, which for the first 6 years was a failure economically, not a failure editorially, but it caught on with the audience finally. And it has probably earned $2 billion in its 25 years on the air. And it's because of quality, a quality that they maintain. And I think that's really, I think that's what determines how much money you make or how successful you are. Look, they want to tell you that you have all kinds of choices now that you didn't have before. When I started, there were three networks. That was it. There wasn't even, you didn't even know there was something called cable television, let alone the existence of it. The new invention at the time was UHF television. You know, there was a channel 32 and all. But today there are hundreds of channels, literally. And if you're on satellite and broadband, you have 200 or 300 channels. But if you added up all the viewers for all those channels, all that fragmentation that networks blame for the low numbers, you probably are still missing 2 to 3 to 4 million viewers, people who have left television because they have better things to do with their time.
Let's talk with somebody here. We've got a caller on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yeah, well, it's a rare honor to be able to talk with someone who actually gets to make decisions. So I'm going to take the opportunity. A few things. One is, I'm one of those people who, well, I really don't watch TV at all, and that's just been my modus operandi for years. I do like NPR's coverage a lot, and one of the things that I like about it is that NPR seems, maybe this is just a relative thing, but they seem to be much more willing to let people talk and say their piece, whatever it is. And that, to me, is one of the things that I think I just get a feeling that a lot of TV stuff is very edited. And I like the fact that it's possible for people to express themselves. And I know that's probably a very difficult thing to do, but from other NPR people, listen to a lot of NPR, kind of say the same thing, that that's one of the things they really like. It's not necessarily that they agree with what the people say, it's that they're allowed to say it. So I'd like to hear your comment on that.
Sure. I think that what you find is that in broadcast television, you're talking about really limited amounts of time. We're talking about in a 30-minute evening news, there's really only 22 minutes of content. It's highly edited. Sound bites get cut down too far, I would think. In cable, I don't have that same excuse to hide behind. I have news 24 hours, 7 days a week. I can't possibly have not enough time to listen to you. So if I say it, it's a shabby excuse. I think people feel a little bit handled too often because there is too much high editing going on. At the college here, at the College of Communications, we're really teaching kids here about the value of content, the value of words. I think the kids who graduate from here are going to be more prone not to let people run on, but to give people their fair say. I think it's gotten to the point where things have gotten maybe too highly edited, and we're going to see the pendulum swing back a bit. But on cable, all the cables, really, there's no excuse for editing that way because you have all the time in the world, literally. And if we do our jobs right, you're not going to feel handled like you do in some other formats.
Yeah, I think the criticism of some cable news is, in fact, that there's not enough editing, that there's too much raw, unconsidered, unedited stuff that goes out there. And it has to do with the fact that you are on 24 hours a day, the pressure not to have somebody get the jump on you on a story. There seems like a lot of pressure to put stuff out before it's really been vetted to the degree it should.
Well, that's a problem that technology causes you, because in olden times, you had to shoot something, ship it in, you had time to check your story, and now You have live cameras. Well, you know, a live picture of something is not journalism. It's not reporting. It's live television. And it's a different exercise. And often people are talking about things that they really don't know about yet because they haven't been able to check yet. You can kind of describe what you see, but you don't really know what's happened until you spend some time checking. But the pressure of that live picture puts people in a position where they tell you more than they know. Mm-hmm. A great sin in this business, telling you more than they know. I also think in terms of letting people run on, you know, talk shows let people run on and confuse talking with reporting. You know, I mean, you start with an untruth and then you discuss it for an hour. By the end of the hour, it sounds like you were discussing something what's true to begin with. You never deal with the reality of that. I think that's a problem. But just on the other side of it a bit, I love NPR. I am second to none in my love of listening to NPR and my need for NPR and my appreciation of NPR. On the other hand, NPR thinks that something that's 10 minutes long is twice as good as something that's 5 minutes long because, after all, it's twice as long. And, you know, there a little more editing would be judicious.
Okay. We'll take that under advisement. We'll go to Belgium over by Danville. Caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, sirs. I'd like to take the opposite point of, well, not exactly the opposite point, but the opposite point of what you were just talking. In this predicament we have ourselves in the Middle East, up to the start of the war in Iraq, news just beat that horse to death. You know, we got to go to war. We got to go to war. We got to do this. We got to do that. And it generated an impression that that's what we had to do, instead of allowing calmer voices to maybe say something about what's going on and then drop it and move on to the next topic. Because I'm sure you noticed that the run-up to the Iraq war, it was 24/7 about going to war with Iraq. And that just incited more wanting to go to war, where reporting it more succinctly might have had a little bit more calming effect.
I think that I differ with you slightly. I was between CNN and MSNBC. I was actually for a year. I came back to ABC News in March in February of last year to run the war coverage there. And prior to that, I'd been at Harvard for 2.5 years, where I'm still actually teaching part-time. I think what happened is directly before the war, and again, I was on the outside looking in directly before the war because I was still teaching, but I think directly before the war, there was a great drumbeat, and I think it was an intimidation of the news media by the administration, which, you know, was kind of waving a flag. It was after 9/11. If you were not supporting the war on terrorism, then you had to be the enemy. And I think news media were a little concerned about being labeled any more left-wing and liberal than some people believe they were to begin with. And I think that caused a great stifling of debate, anti-war or moderate war debate immediately prior. But even before that, I mean, before the great drumbeat started, which really started in December or November of 2002, prior to that, I think that what there was a total lack of discussion and debate over what we ought to be doing. When the first seeds of maybe we ought to go to war with Iraq were first being sown, instead of analyzing, well, should we be going to war? Is Saddam Hussein somehow responsible for 9/11? Is he part of the war on terrorism? Is this where we want to commit our resources? What is the fallout if we go to war with Iraq, in Iran, in Saudi Arabia? What kind of a coalition are we going to have? What will it mean in Syria? What will the French and the Germans and what will it do to the British government or the Spanish government? Instead of a discussion like that, and instead of a discussion about, and what kind of a coalition can we build? And is it broad enough and deep enough? And are we spending enough time building that coalition? All those points that we seem to be wanting to get to now, when in the view of some, is a little late because we're there, let's deal with the reality of it. I think at a time when the news media should have been broaching those points, they felt constrained, and that's really a problem.
Yes, you hit the nail on the head with this administration. You either believe us or you're against us. And that's a very poor way to run a democratic country. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Our guest this morning is part of Focus 580, Rick Kaplan. He just recently was hired to run MSNBC. Before that was teaching at Harvard. Before that was head of domestic operations for CNN. Before that worked for ABC. Before that worked for CBS. And
but you left out between Harvard and MS. I was in charge of war coverage for ABC, and then I ran the hard news operation.
Okay.
So Nightline, World News Tonight, the political unit reported to me.
So he's now been at every network.
Yeah,
that
it's
there
a, you know, when you can't hold a job, you just get a hell of a resume out of it.
He's here visiting the campus, spending some time with journalism students, and we're interested in your comments on the news media. What do you think about the product that came out of the embedded reporters during the Iraq War?
Yeah, I'm actually I don't want to say a fan of it, but I'm going to say they did a whole lot better than people think they did. If you talk to the embedded reporters there, first of all, reporters have been embedded in wars forever. You go back to the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, there were embedded reporters of a sort. And just because you could show up in Vietnam and show up with a, you know, with a bunch of GIs and say, hey, you know, here's my press card, and now you had to be literally carted out by the military to get to your unit, doesn't mean that the journalists who were embedded today were any less free than the journalists before. There's always been a set of rules about, look, you don't give away your position. You don't put in jeopardy the people you're there covering. There's always that unspoken but very clear set of rules. You don't do treasonous things. I mean, I spent a month with the Khmer Rouge, and they're not exactly good guys, and I had kind of the same deal with them. What happened was in the first Gulf War, where the administration was still reeling because the officers in charge were the Vietnam officers, and they're going, well, we can't let the press near here because if we get into a Vietnam kind of thing, they're going to kill us with their coverage, and it's going to be a disaster. And then what do you know? We go to war with Iraq the first time. We walk through their military. I mean, this was a war where with the exception of a couple of days, I don't think we had hardly any casualties that we knew about at the time. And so it was an extraordinary military triumph in the first Gulf War that nobody saw. And when they got done with that, they said, well, we can't let that happen again because Americans ought to know this. I guess our military is as good as we hoped it would be. And so this time they were hard put to make, or they were dedicated to making sure they wouldn't miss the upside of a well-fought war. And so they embedded journalists. Now, they had to do that for a number of reasons. For the first and most important, perhaps, the Arab world had its own set of journalists show up for the first time. Al Jazeera and Dubai and Gulf States. There were a lot of Arab media. So if you're not covering it with American media, well, all the Muslim states are going to be covering it with their media, not necessarily friendly. And the BBC was there, not necessarily friendly. And the whole world and local stations were sending people. So there are literally hundreds and hundreds of journalists now, which is infinitely more than there were in the Vietnam War at any one time. And you've got to make some order out of it. And we did want to get press out with the troops. Now, our troops, our press people who were out there, they were not handled at all. You were free to report. There's probably less censorship of a sort than ever. And the thing you just had to make sure of with your reporters is that just report on what you see. You could be having a really bad day, but the war may not be going badly. So don't talk about the war going badly. You can talk about your day being crummy. Or if your day's going beautifully, the war may not be. So again, tell us what you see. Tell us what you can report firsthand. Don't go beyond that. And with the exception, again, of those rules that are obvious, which is, you know, don't tell everybody where the unit is and all that, there was little or no censorship, and the military was pretty terrific about it.
Yeah. Well, that, you know,
and the reporting was accurate.
The media criticism, though, says that that it was a stroke of genius on the part of the Pentagon because they managed to maintain the appearance of openness and yet at the same time having complete control over the message.
Well, you know what? It wasn't the appearance of openness. It was openness. You could kind of go anywhere. If they had just said, go on your own, you could not drive through Iraq as fast as our military did. And if you did try to drive through Iraq, you know, again, cars stalled, cars broke down, even the ones that were outfitted for desert work. You just couldn't get through the country. And again, our military was moving so quickly, we couldn't keep our own military supplied with gasoline. Can you imagine what a press car would have been into? So you really had to get there with the military to stay up with the war. And it was extraordinarily dangerous. More journalists lost their lives in the early days than military. And it's obviously incredibly dangerous to be there now. And again, it wasn't the appearance of openness. It was openness. And more than anything, you needed the military to get to where the battle was. You know, in Vietnam, you're there forever, and it's a small area, and you go up the river a few clicks, and you're at a unit, and the war was being fought everywhere. Here, you're racing at 50 miles an hour. Literally, the war's going on 50 miles an hour. And if you get behind it too much, some of the Fayyadeen fall in behind our units, and you'll be killed. And a number of people who were killed because they got away from the military.
Yeah. Let's talk with some other folks here, and let's go to... cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi. I'm a political pundit junkie. And from 9 to 1, I watch all the pundits, and it's actually the most amusing stuff on TV. And it would be great just, I mean, they have zero accountability. But what I wanted to ask you is this. Some people say that when a journalist becomes a pundit, it biases their ability to report objectively. I don't believe that. I believe that a reporter's bias is already there, and when I get to listen to them as a pundit, I get to know what those biases are, so that, in fact, it helps me in analyzing or accepting or not accepting what they're saying. What do you think about this journalist punditry situation? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, I think that it can get out of control, and I think that I'm not happy with journalists becoming pundits because I think they lose some perspective themselves. You know, the truth is, if you're a human being short of a hermit, and then I guess you have a bias against people, so I guess every human being becomes biased in some ways, and what a journalist is distinguished by is his or her ability to recognize their own biases and make sure that as a trained journalist, they remain fair, accurate, and balanced. And I think when you become a pundit, you tend to blur that. It becomes, it's certainly a lot of fun to sit here and say, oh, so-and-so is an idiot and so-and-so is a moron and this party doesn't know what it's doing or this guy's whatever. And it starts, I just don't think you can go back and forth across that line. I think that is a serious problem and I don't like to see, it's very few people can jump back and forth. Let's just put it that way.
All right. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah. I have two areas. One is that in terms of the war, when we talk about collateral damage, I know it's part of that in the media here, we don't talk about the others that were killed. You know, there's a tendency to sort of whitewash war. The second point in terms of commenting on is... what's your feeling about this trend toward more mergers and acquisitions in the mass media, especially, you know, networks also able to buy, what, additional TV stations and newspapers and all that sort of thing, and radio stations?
Right.
So I'll let you comment on that.
Oh, God. So first, let's deal with collateral damage. That's a term I kind of hate, collateral damage. It falls into the same category for me as friendly fire. You know, if you're, I've been under friendly fire, and I didn't find it accommodating, actually. You know, collateral damage is a reality of war. I've tried, you know, we had an incident even last week when the five American soldiers were blown up in Fallujah, and the four, I don't know in the end how to characterize them. They were both bodyguards and aid workers and stuff. And they were not only shot to death and burned, but then mutilated and dragged through the streets and hung from a bridge. And you sit there and you walk a fine line because I don't want people to think war is fun or clean or neat. Collateral damage is not something pleasant. Collateral damage is as devastating as targeted damage. But you do walk a thin line because, for instance, I would not put on the air, there were incredibly graphic pictures that, and I've been in eight wars that I will not forget. They were that horrible. And if I put them on, oh, you're going to know what war's like, but I don't think I need to do that. But I don't want to get to the point where I make it so clean that you're accepting of it and comfortable with it. So that's a problem. It's tragic, and I don't think we do anybody a service by making war something that seems like an academic exercise. Now, in terms of mergers, I don't know, maybe we'd be better off talking about the chief, but you talk about...
Forget it.
But in terms of controversial subjects, these mega mergers, they have a potential, and I want to underline that. It's a potential for the business to run off the tracks. The fewer people who are in charge or owning our companies, the fewer owners there are, the less competition there is. The larger companies get who own a lot of these media, television, and especially radio and print news outlets, the fewer people who control the news outlets, be it printed or spoken, that's not good for the business. And you do reach a point, a tipping point of sorts, where too few own too much. And that will potentially, it has not yet come to that, but it could potentially, in the wrong hands, really limit the sources of your information, really limit the independence of a newsroom, and be a really bad thing. But, you know, this is an FCC, and there's an FCC chairman here who has a differing point of view. And, you know, and this may be the most editorial thing I'd like to tell you, which is I just wish Colin Powell had found another job for his son.
There, some people would say that when you look at the number of large companies that control media and how much media, and broadly speaking, they control,
right,
they'd say we passed the tipping point. If you've got six or seven companies that between them hold most of the books, magazines, the recording industry, movie studios, newspapers, internet, cable, everything, you know, these huge multimedia conglomerates.
Four or five companies, not six or seven, four or five own. If you have broadband and you got 150 channels, four or five of them own the giant preponderance of those channels. Whether, I mean, conglomerates own HBO and Showtime and ESPN and Fox Sports and Bravo and Lifetime and A&E and USA and the list goes on. All the stations, all the networks I promise you've heard of are parts of some big company or another, in the same way that General Motors owns Ford, Chevrolet, in the same way that General Motors owns Chevrolet, Oldsmobile, and Buick. And so a lot of times, actually, when they complain about fragmentation, it's really like GM complaining that Chevy lost sales because too many people started buying Buicks. Well, you know, that goes into the same bank account. So a lot of that anger about, or that frustration about fragmentation, is just a different profit line is reporting the revenue. And again, though, in the end, anytime you see something that is clever, is smart, is quality, even if it's quality in a genre, whether it's The Apprentice or CSI or Law and Order or West Wing or a lot of the, you know, really extraordinary shows that are on TV, Friends was certainly one of them, people come to those kinds of quality presentations. I'm more concerned about when you get into a situation where independent producers, whether it be entertainment or news, find they only have three or four places to stop for to sell their product, and that's a problem. And, you know, right now you're in a situation where NPR, where public radio and public television have no money. And so you talk to independent producers of television projects, and they'll tell you they can't get a deal from PBS because they're happy to put it on if you come with the funding. Well, that's hard to find in a tough time.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually remarkable that a place like HBO now has been they actually have money. They're one of the places that they're actually willing to put some money into documentary production.
Well, because they have proven, and that's why they say HBO. It's not television; it's HBO. It's a Time Warner company, and it has done what it's done by really, truly doing quality television, whether you like it or not, or approve of it or not. Because some of their shows are on the edge and could be over the line for some people. The point is, whatever they do is extraordinarily well done for its genre.
Well, and they also can, the way they define success in terms of numbers is different from the way, say, NBC does. HBO can be happier with a much smaller audience.
Well, because they can replay it. You see, the problem here is NBC can't take a show and play it 39 times a week. But you know, The Sopranos is played, you know, I can't imagine how many times a week. And it costs a lot of money to get HBO, and they get a lot in fees. And, you know, it's just, and they do it you couldn't afford to do Angels in America for the screen. First of all, it's 6 hours. Second of all, the stars, each one of those stars is, you know, eight-digit stars, but they'll all work because it's Mike Nichols, and he'll do it because it's HBO, and he gets 6 hours. So they have, you know, it's a two-way street here.
Got a caller here on cell phone, line four. Hello.
Yes. I'm curious. You said you covered a number of wars. Did you cover Vietnam? Is that right?
No, I came. I was actually too young, thank God, to be in the middle of the Vietnam War. I didn't get to Vietnam until actually the war was over. My first time in Vietnam, I was in Cambodia.
But did you recall how many people were killed in the Vietnam War?
American soldiers, or more than 50,000.
Ah. You know, you're one of the first people that I asked that question. If you ask the American public, most everybody will quote a figure if they know, somewhere around 50,000, and that's only Americans. Do you know how many Vietnamese were killed?
Well, no one is quite sure, because if you do American body counts, you're over the population of Vietnam, but it's probably in excess of 4 million.
That's right, and that's the unofficial. 2 million is the official. But my point is that the wars that we are covering, including the Korean War and American history, the reporting is strictly on the American side, because very few people know, even today, how many Iraqis have been killed in the first Gulf War and how many Iraqis have been killed during this last episode.
Well, you're exactly right. In fact, we don't know how many Iraqis died.
And I think this is a misjustice of reporting if we don't cover both sides.
Well, I will tell you, we have made enormous efforts, and I'm not alone in this, now having been in two networks during just this Iraq conflict. Everybody's really trying very hard to try to pin down how many Iraqis have died, and we can't. I mean, there are no numbers, either officially or unofficially, that are kind of trustworthy numbers. There just are no estimates about it, and it is a tragedy. Look, when you go to war, everybody is hurt by it. Everyone. It is a terrible thing. It is a total last resort, or ought to be a last resort for anybody. And we try very hard to find out what the losses were on the other side, and we don't. But as long as we're in the quiz business, do you know how many people died at Gettysburg and during our Civil War?
There was something like close to 50,000.
Right. One battle.
That's exactly right, and that's both sides. But the point is, though, that we know our American history when we talk about our own soldiers, but we don't know about how many people were killed, how many Russians were killed in the Second World War, or maybe why they might have an agenda in the Cold War, how many people were killed in Vietnam, and maybe the war wouldn't have been extended that long if we knew we were killing millions of them. The point is, I don't think that we're really being very good reporters if we can't cover both sides of the tragedy.
Well, I think that's a point well taken.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, that's it, and I think maybe that gets at the larger criticism that one of the ways we fail, news media often fail, is in background, providing background, context. Maybe we're pretty good at saying what's happening at this place right here, right now, but not so good at trying to explain to people all of those things that led up to whatever it is that's happening at that place right there, right now.
I think that I'm not sure I agree with that, because I know how much time is spent on broadcast networks and cable networks and in newspapers, solid newspapers and magazines. A lot of time is spent trying to answer exactly those questions. And I know at ABC and Time magazine did extensive reporting to try to take stock on what the condition of Iraq was after and how the cities were being dealt with. I know that effort is constantly underway. But, you know, history is not necessarily instantaneous, and sometimes it takes a generation or more to know exactly what did happen way back when. Documents aren't freed up. Documents are frozen in time by all kinds of governments, and we learn about things late. But I know that a huge effort is underway and is constantly underway to answer just those questions.
Urbana, next caller, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that you were talking about unedited broadcast time, and I was thinking that though I do kind of enjoy MSNBC more than some of the other news networks, what I really prefer is C-SPAN. And I spent a lot of time watching C-SPAN, and fortunately it's keeping me from going to satellite, because I hate to lose that.
You see, I'm with you. I like C-SPAN a lot, too. I like the idea. Maybe it's the journalist in both of us, because you get it, and it's kind of like, you know, I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to listen to an entire hearing. I'm going to listen to an entire speech, and it's, you know, it's fun. It's the raw data, and I've always liked the raw material. It's not an efficient way. You know, you in the course of a day on C-SPAN, you can kind of get in a daylight day, you can get one story an hour, one event an hour, and sometimes it's, I mean, I think it's great fun, but obviously our world has many more stories than that, that if you're a working journalist or if you're going to watch a newscast, you kind of have to choose and edit that down. But I'm with you. I think C-SPAN is an absolutely necessary extra channel for everybody to have, and I've found myself more often than not watching it.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes you have to trade off efficiency for effectiveness.
I think maybe you're right.
But I want to ditto the person that started out by saying we'd like to hear less uncritical acceptance of a Washington point of view, no matter what the subject. But I've got a question about, you mentioned 60 Minutes, and since you brought it up, there's this curious thing that happened this is a good opportunity to ask someone in the business. Last October, 60 Minutes had a segment on Greg Thielman, who was the director of the Office of Strategic Proliferation and Military Affairs, which was responsible for analyzing Iraqi weapons threat for Secretary Powell. And they had him on last October, and they repeated it fairly recently. And what was curious to me was that was such a damning take on Colin Powell's presentation in front of the United Nations, where he claimed Iraq was such a threat and all, whereas Thielman said, I didn't even think it, to quote him, he said, I think it didn't even constitute an imminent threat to its neighbors at the time we went to war, unquote. You know, and he just totally destroyed Powell's take on the whole thing. And yet, this didn't seem to have any effect on the news networks at all. After this, even after it's showing twice, nobody says, you know, the discredited Colin Powell. Nobody goes any less often to Colin Powell. And I'm just completely baffled. Oh, what is it? What do you think is going on here? Is how can 60 Minutes have such a high rating, you know, year after year, and yet there's no, there doesn't seem to be any kind of logical follow-up from the program.
Well, first, let me tell you, I have not seen either of the pieces, but I will tell you that all the networks have done pieces that I would say, if you were being kind, you would say merely discredited Colin Powell, or at least his testimony before the UN. I think he got slammed big time over that. Repeatedly for a period of weeks, and I think that he'll be slammed more. It's not over about that, but you got to remember, I don't think it's the job of the media to pick up on a subject and take a political point of view and run with it, although I'm sure people on the left and the right think that's all we do. The truth is, the criticism you have is more in line with the criticism that we get from all sides of an issue, that, well, why don't you pick up with that and, you know, beat the guy over the head until he's a bloody mess. I think Colin Powell gets amply criticized for that testimony and for not sticking up for what he did, although we don't know what he did behind closed doors, do we? We may learn a lot about that in Woodward's next book, but I think he's gotten extraordinary criticism for it. And again, I didn't see the 60 Minutes piece.
Well, there may have been short-term criticism for it, but
it keeps coming back. I mean,
he was criticized.
I mean, I can think of three or four different periods where he went through a week of criticism on the air every single night, and it's going to come back again during these 9/11 hearings. I mean, you're going to hear, you've not heard the end of where did you come off giving that testimony before the UN, which now seems totally discredited. He even gets discredited when the 9/11 Commission interviews George Tenet, you know, about CIA intelligence and what they were giving people, and what did you give Colin Powell that caused him to sit there and in the end tell stories that turned out to be wrong or untrue.
Well, I guess I don't watch enough MSNBC.
There you go. That's the solution to a lot of difficulties in this world.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, don't I get a commercial for being here?
Well, I've only mentioned MSNBC about 14 times.
What station?
I don't know. I don't watch that much TV. Lafayette is next. Line one.
Hi. I guess my question is just a different formulation of the last one, but I was already online when that person started. But I guess my last civics class was in a parochial school some decades ago. But I'm just wondering what people are being, quote, taught to expect of a news media in a democracy. It seems that they are perfectly willing to accept patriotic pablum and rather than two-sided coverage many-sided coverage, let's say, of a war. And it seems then that the administration, and the government especially, in the current administration, is working against that any ideal of a civics teacher that would teach people to think or to analyze or to demand good media or know what perhaps information in a media an environment should be in a democracy.
Well, that's, I mean, I understand exactly where you're coming from on that. I think that students, for instance, at the University of Illinois School of Communications are taught that, you know, they have responsibility as journalists to complete their mission, as it were, a mission being to serve the needs of their fellow citizens. And at least that's my interpretation of it. And that means telling people things they want to know and things they need to know and things they need to know that they don't even know they need to know. And I think that means being fair and square about your government and the activities of your nation, good, bad, or indifferent. And you know, it's interesting. I think there may be, I don't know if it's just the nature of the audience for this radio station or if this is representative of a general feeling, but the truth is I'm not sure the White House appreciates fully the number of people who are not at all willing to just accept what the administration, the direction the administration has taken us in Iraq or elsewhere. There's the more you get out and you get away from Washington and New York, where there's this feeling is very open and predominant, you get doses of it in places that you don't quite expect it. I will tell you quite honestly that I'm surprised. This is central Illinois, and this is supposed to be an area of the country that is, you know, I come from Illinois, so I think it's the true heartland of America and the greatest, strongest, you know, one of the most wonderful places to bring up children and to live, and I'm a big fan. But I also think, you know, it's a conservative place that's, we recognize the great virtues of being in this country and the great privilege of living in it as Americans and all that. And I'm just kind of surprised that the degree of criticism has been, you know, just on this radio show, but not just here, in other places I've been around town. There's a lot of uneasiness about the direction the country's going in militaristically. And it's interesting.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it does seem that some people paint the media with this stroke of, you know, being all liberal based on a certain expectation that any kind of, you know, in-depth discussion is unpatriotic. But
yeah, see, I don't buy, I'll tell you, I you know, because God knows I hear the criticism about liberal media. It's just not my experience at all. Most journalists I work with actually don't care who gets elected, and almost, you know, it's like you go into things, you don't really care which way it comes out as long as you got it right and you got it fair and you were accurate about it, and because you know they'll be hell to pay if you didn't get it right. And You know, the liberal media, if you talk to people who are unabashed liberals looking at the media, they're going to tell you liberal media. This is a conservative media cowed by the administration and all the rest. So I don't know. I was always brought up that if you were getting shot at from both sides, maybe you were doing it right. It's just not fun getting shot at from all sides.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Thanks. Let's go on to Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I'm another skeptic, I guess. And what I would like to know about, I think you left CNN right around the time this PSYOP scandal happened. What was anybody thinking of CNN having psychological operation people from the, I guess it was the DIA, wasn't the CIA, in the newsroom to observe how news is created? What were they thinking? And did you have anything to do with that? Were you aghast when you found out? Or
yeah, I'm not sure I was there. I think it happened actually before I was there, but wasn't known about until after. You know, it's one of those things where it went unnoticed, untalked about. It's a horror and a mistake, and I think that the people who would be most responsible for it now, or at all responsible for it now, are all kind of gone. But it was something that had happened prior to my being there. It wasn't known, I don't think, until after I'd already left.
Well, Ethan Jordan, is he gone?
Well, he's without power.
Oh.
So he's well, kind of been kicked upstairs. And exactly, and, you know, that should be the least of his difficulties or the least of his mistakes, and we don't need to go there. But it's, yeah, I mean, there are people, you know, it's when you forget what your job is and you do things that are just wrong and you endanger people. You endanger, you know, when you don't do your job as a journalist properly and you err in that way. I've been in too many places around the world where, because journalists from other countries in many cases, too many cases, are agents of the governments that they are nationals of. And so when you go to those countries, and they're usually not the nicest places on the planet, they just assume, well, you're American media, you must be CIA, and that puts you in danger. And every time somebody does something that just, you know, propels that notion in foreign capitals, you endanger all of your colleagues at all the other American news media, including your own, who might be in that country and other countries, because they say, see, you're CIA, you did PSYOPs, you had government in there, you were... And it's just, it's such a disservice, and it's so dangerous, and it's so harmful. And frankly, I, you know, again, I wasn't there when the story did come out, but it would have been worth firing anybody who had anything to do with that, if for no other reason to make the point to other capitals that we are not agents of any government. Well, in fact, our government's more than happy to have you take us hostage anytime you wish.
Actually, Carl Bernstein, in a short article that he never developed any further in the year of intelligence or just after that, I think it goes back to 76. It was only published in Rolling Stone, and it's available on scratchy microfilm. So if there's any J School students out there listening, you can dig that out. But he never did anything with it, but it goes through a lot of the cooperation that was going on between the CIA and journalists around the world. So actually, I think there is actually a lot more of that going on than people actually want to admit at this point.
And I would tell you that from my experience, and I wouldn't say this if I didn't believe this for sure, I think there's a whole lot less of that going on than you think. If what we're talking about is the mainstream media of the major three broadcast networks and New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune kind of places.
Well, what you believe and what might be true is, or it may be two different things. And
I'm speaking from experience. I'm not trying to guess at it.
Well, I think we're going to quibble. And if there's not another caller, there's only a minute to wrap up. So thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thanks. Guy's got a good watch.
There's lots of things we could talk about. One thing I'm really curious about is what's your reaction to the lack of criticism that Robert Novak received for his role in outing the CIA agent?
I don't think that's over yet. And I'm not sure. You know, they're trying to figure out who is it who leaked it to Novak and how did it come to that? And he may not be alone. And that's not over. I think it's a grand jury. If not a grand jury, it's a special prosecutor who are looking into that. So we're not done with that. So maybe we wait and see how that resolves.
I can't help believing
Robert Novak, an alum of the University of Illinois.
Well, he went to school here, but I think he didn't actually graduate from here. He's very careful about it and how he talks about that. The thing, I guess, that it strikes me is if this had happened during the Clinton administration, people like him would have been howling for blood. And it seems to me that that people on the conservative side of the chattering classes have been remarkably silent about whether or not that was appropriate when he did.
You know, basically what happens is lots of things happen here, and the results are, in a partisan way, quite predictable. Novak would have been all over somebody on the left who would have done it, and, you know, I don't know what to say.
Oh, okay.
You would leave me speechless. A good time to end.
Well, thank you very much for being
My
here.
Pleasure.
Rick Kaplan just recently was hired to head MSNBC. I won't do his whole resume, but
Please.
He's been around broadcast
like
news for a long time and is now spending some time on the campus, as he has done before many times, working with journalism students here. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Programming here on WILL is made possible with support from the Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Beethoven's Fidelio Overture, Romance No. 2 with Sherban Lupu, and Piano Concerto No. 5 with pianist Charles Rosen on Wednesday, April 7th, 7:30 in the evening in the Follinger Great Hall at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. For more information, you can call 333-6280.